Governor Inslee has the veto power, but is he wielding that veto with too much power? We're going to get into that here in a few minutes on The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in today. Our top story now, our state is scheduled to fully reopen at the end of June, but with unvaccinated people still getting COVID at high rates and new variants that are more contagious, this pandemic is not over. So let's learn more and answer your questions with virologist Angela Rasmussen with the Vaccine and Infectious Disease Research Organization at the University of Saskatchewan in Canada. Dr. Rasmussen, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me back, Bill.
Good to talk with you. And Dr. Rasmussen, we'll take your questions. So give us a call right now. Again, here's the phone number, area code 206-543-KUOW. Again, that's 543-5869. If you call now, we'll try to get your question in. Dr. Rasmussen, you left Seattle. Did you move to Saskatchewan even with the border closed?
I did. It took about 6 months, I think, to get all of my immigration paperwork together for myself and my spouse. But we moved, we drove into Canada on April 20th, and then, of course, had to do a very strict mandatory two-week quarantine before I could actually start my new job and start my new lab.
Yeah. Well, we might talk about Canada a little bit later if we get time. I want to ask about the fact that we've got, Seattle famously more than three quarters fully vaccinated now, King County up near 70%, but other parts of Washington and the U.S. and the world are less vaccinated. So how much do you think COVID transmission among unvaccinated people is going to allow this virus to mutate and eventually become resistant to our vaccines and break out again?
Well, I don't know if the virus is ever going to become completely resistant to our vaccines, and certainly I hope that's not the case. But it really does provide, I think, some more urgency to the need to get people vaccinated everywhere and get them fully vaccinated everywhere. As you just pointed out, Seattle is doing wonderfully in terms of the number of people who've been vaccinated who are eligible, but there are many other places, including in Washington State, including elsewhere in King County, that people have not necessarily been getting those vaccines. There are many parts of the country also in which people simply don't have access to the vaccines. So this is something that we really need to get on top of. We really need to make sure that we are getting vaccines out to everybody who wants one. People who don't want one, we need to try to understand why they don't and hopefully convince them otherwise. Because as long as we have large populations of people that are unvaccinated, the virus will continue to spread among them. And in fact, that's exactly what we're seeing throughout the U.S. now. In communities like Seattle, case numbers continue to go down. In communities elsewhere, for example, in the South, there's a very low vaccination rate in states like Mississippi and Alabama. We are seeing cases start to increase. And we're seeing this on a county-by-county basis as well. Where counties that have rolled out vaccines to the majority of their adult population are seeing declines that are sustained. Communities that have not had the same coverage with vaccination are seeing case numbers start to go up.
Okay, so then first for the unvaccinated population, how bad do you expect this pandemic to get among that group? Let's say compared to things at their worst last year among unvaccinated people. How and we've got the variants. How bad do you think it's going to be?
So I mean, I think if we are looking at nationwide numbers, it's not going to look as bad as it did last winter, because we will see what looks like less of an increase in cases should we have a winter surge among unvaccinated people. And that's because nationwide, that will be balanced out by the people who are fully vaccinated and will be protected, and those communities won't see surges. But I think that, we certainly have the potential to see local epidemics, local surges that could be pretty bad. And globally, certainly, we are going to be seeing increases in cases around the world in different countries, especially ones that don't have access to vaccines at all, similar to what we've seen recently in India, in Nepal, and in Thailand and some other countries that initially did really well during the pandemic. So as long as there are large populations of people who don't have access to vaccines and are not fully vaccinated, we will continue to see surges in cases until we really roll out the vaccines on a global scale.
And then you've sort of answered this, but then I want to talk now about vaccinated people. How much of a threat is the still lack of vaccination in some quarters? How much of a threat is that to vaccinated people?
So from the data that we have so far, unvaccinated people do not pose a threat to fully vaccinated people. We know that especially the mRNA vaccines provide excellent protection against infection as well as against disease. We know that Johnson & Johnson provides excellent protection against severe disease. So people who are vaccinated can really rest easy that they are protected. It's really the partially vaccinated or the unvaccinated people that we have to worry about. Okay. Or people who have pre-existing conditions, for example, people who have received organ transplants, people who are immunosuppressed, who don't have robust protective immune responses when they're given the vaccine. Those right. are all the people who are going to need to worry.
Our first question, again, we're taking calls for Dr. Rasmussen. It's area code 206-543-KUOW, 543-5869. Jeff from Seattle writes to us, how long does it take for us to figure out if vaccines are resistant to new variants?
So that's a really tough question because it's really hard. The only way you can see if this happens in the real world is to look at a vaccinated population over a period of time and then compare them to an unvaccinated population. And that's really how you look at what's called effectiveness. That's different than efficacy, which is what you measure in a clinical trial. So it's really very difficult to just go into the lab and do a test and determine if a particular variant is going to completely evade the protection that a single vaccine causes, because the immune system is more complex than just, you know, neutralizing antibodies. Which people hear about those tests a lot. You know, they say this particular variant is X percent fewer neutralizing antibodies than this other variant. But that really doesn't tell us that much about functional immunity in the real world. And that's good news for all of us because the immune system is so complex. That means there's also redundancies and fail-safes, essentially. So even if a variant is capable of evading some of those neutralizing antibody responses, there's still T cells, there's still non-neutralizing antibodies, all of which can work together to clear an infection and keep you safe and keep you from getting really sick. So for now, the good news is, even though some of these variants of concern are indeed concerning, there are no indications that any of them are capable of completely evading the protection provided by the vaccines that we have.
This is Dr. Angela Rasmussen with the Vaccine and Infectious Disease Research Organization at University of Saskatchewan in Canada, and we're taking your calls, 206-543-KUOW. Some of what we've covered, Doctor, is familiar to listeners. I wonder, in general, where you think the conventional wisdom is off when it comes to this virus or this pandemic. Is there something you want us to know that you think most listeners might not know?
Well, I think that people are very confused about immunity provided by vaccines and immunity provided by natural infection. And this is something that is really hard to clarify because ultimately we've done clinical trials to look at the immunity that vaccines provide. We know that it's very robust. We can't really do clinical trials with people who've been infected in the real world because people are infected at different times, they have different pre-existing conditions. It's just a lot harder to figure that out. So I think there's this misunderstanding that either vaccine-induced immunity is just equivalent to natural immunity or that natural immunity doesn't exist at all, and neither of those things are true. We do know that vaccines consistently induce protective immune responses. Natural infection doesn't always do that, but at the same time, natural infection does provide immunity. Your immune system works regardless of whether you get infected or you get a vaccine. It just might not work as well. So that's why the recommendation still is that people who have been infected and have had COVID before should still get vaccinated because we know that the vaccine reliably can induce that protection. But I think that there's a big misunderstanding that, you know, your immune system is not working unless you're getting a vaccine. Your immune system does work. The vaccines just allow it to work at its most optimal level.
That's true. Sometimes we talk about unvaccinated as if it equals unprotected, but that's not necessarily true, and especially given that the virus has been circulating for a while. Okay, let's take a phone call from Mary Alice from Port Angeles. Mary Alice, what would you like to know from Dr. Rasmussen?
Hello, Bill. Thanks for taking my call. I've been an avid listener of your program for a long time, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
My husband and I are in our 80s, and we got the vaccines when they were first available to us here on the peninsula. And so we've been completely protected, and we've been very protective of ourselves and our lifestyle. We've kept pretty much sequestered, and we're doing fine. My question is, we have people coming in from outside who are fleeing the big city and looking for a little solitude, a lot of whom are not protected. And I was wondering if there is going to be a booster available, because how long do we know the vaccine lasts, and would it be a good protective measure? We do have family coming in from Idaho in September, and we're trying to get all of them vaccinated, but they may not all do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what about a booster, Dr. Rasmussen?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, and that's kind of the million-dollar question right now. Unfortunately, the only way we can determine how long immunity that a vaccine provides lasts is to just wait that amount of time and wait until we start to see it wane. Now, that is being monitored very closely, and so far, at least, it appears that the vaccines can produce protective responses that last for at least 6 months. So I would guess that people are going to have protection for at least a year. But at the same time, I think that the caller is in an age group and in a risk group where they will be first in line to get boosters should there be a signal that immunity is waning. And I know that also in older folks, that is being monitored especially closely, because it is well known that as you get older, your immune system may not be as robust in terms of its responses as it is in younger people. So I think that the caller can rest assured that should boosters be necessary, she will be first in line to get them.
And you think with all the regulatory understandable hurdles, you know, this stuff takes time. Do you think people like Mary Alice can feel confident that they'll get the okay to get a booster before it gets, you know, so dangerous that it's too late for some people who could have used one?
Yeah, I do. And I'm assuming that Mary Alice got either the Pfizer or the Moderna vaccine. And there have already been clinical trials performed on a third booster shot, including one that accounts for one of the variants, the beta variant or the B1351 variant that was first discovered in South Africa. So we do have some data on that. In addition to that, both of the mRNA vaccine manufacturers have announced that they are planning to submit a BLA or biologics license application, which is an application for full FDA approval. Once that is issued, it really should not be much of a regulatory hassle at all, especially given that we have some data about it and boosters do have to recommend those for people who need them urgently.
Okay, good. Again, virologist Dr. Angela Rasmussen, Vaccine and Infectious Disease Research Organization, University of Saskatchewan. And we're taking your call, 206-543-KUOW. And our next phone call is from Barbara, who's in Montlake Terrace. Barbara, welcome, and what's your question?
Hi, I have been vaccinated, both of them, quite some time ago, but I have diabetes, and I have a couple of friends who are very hesitant about being vaccinated. So what are the risk factors for me and for them?
Well, that's a great question, Barbara, because diabetes is definitely a risk factor for severe COVID. Now, you've been fully vaccinated. You've had both shots. That means you are protected. However, your friends, depending on what kind of pre-existing conditions they have, if they also are diabetic, then they would be at higher risk for severe COVID. So my recommendation to them, of course, would be to get vaccinated as soon as possible. and you mentioned that they might be a little reluctant to do that, I'd be curious to hear what their reasons are for being reluctant, because there's a lot of different reasons why some people have not gotten vaccinated. Sometimes it's an issue of access. Sometimes it's just that people have questions, reasonable questions. I mean, these vaccines were developed incredibly quickly. I think it's natural for people to want to know, yes, they're safe, yes, they work. And for that, I would encourage your friends to seek out people like me. I'm on social media. There are people, in their communities, in their doctor's offices, at the Washington State Department of Health, all across the board, who can hopefully address some of their concerns and hopefully persuade them to also get fully vaccinated and enjoy that protection for themselves.
Barbara, thank you for calling. So Barbara is one of many people wondering, in her case, it's what do I do regarding unvaccinated friends? What about in other ways, given where we are in the pandemic now, Dr. Rasmussen, what should KUOW listeners be doing or not doing when it comes to masking and social distancing, but also even things like traveling? Where's your advice now?
So if people are fully vaccinated, I mean, I think that the CDC's recommendations have been very confusing, but they are based in science. They're based on evidence that people who are fully vaccinated can do many of these activities safely without needing to take additional precautions. However, what is confusing about it is that people who have not been fully vaccinated would still be expected to take many of those precautions. They would still need to wear masks, for example. They would still be discouraged from gathering indoors for long periods of time, including in restaurants and things like that with people outside of their household. So I think it's really tough. And my recommendation to everybody, of course, is to get vaccinated as soon as possible. But let's say that you have small children who can't get vaccinated yet, or let's say that you are immunosuppressed, or you've had an organ transplant, or you have HIV that's not well controlled. All of those things would certainly cause a vaccine. You know, even if you're vaccinated, it would cause concern if people in your family are going to be around other unvaccinated people. And that's why ultimately it is really important that everybody who can get vaccinated can do so. Because that is what allows it to be safe for people who aren't yet ready to be vaccinated. In terms of, vaccines aren't approved for children. Some people simply medically can't take vaccines. So my recommendation in terms of how people should behave over the summer, it's a little bit easier, because if you can be outside and you're with a mixed crowd of some people who are not yet vaccinated, that's a much safer environment to be in than getting together indoors. I'm definitely more worried about the winter time, the fall and winter, in communities where there is not a high vaccination rate, because then people will be gathering indoors, especially if they're gathering for things like the holidays. They're not wearing masks. They will be around the table together eating and potentially being exposed to a large number of people outside their household who haven't been vaccinated. So again, I mean, I sound like a broken record, but the best thing you can do is, if you are eligible for vaccination, to get vaccinated fully as soon as you can.
Let's talk about a group who has no idea what the phrase broken record means. I'm talking about children under 12. We hear that they're going to be eligible for vaccination maybe autumn. Is that still true? And how young do you think that'll go?
So I think this really depends. Right now, the trials for younger children are what's called an age de-escalation study. So they start off looking at kids who are ages 9 to 11, and then they move progressively down to younger and younger kids until they're going to be testing the vaccines in six-month-old infants. So I think that it is possible that by the fall, potentially, if the trial gets results for that older group of children, we could see a recommendation that they would then be eligible for vaccination. But I think to really be able to vaccinate all children from the ages of 6 months up is going to be until sometime next year. So there will be a large population of kids that will remain unvaccinated into 2022. I think also, though, that people should keep in mind that, the risk to kids can be mitigated in the meantime by taking some precautions. When those kids are indoors, they should wear masks. If you and everybody you are around is getting vaccinated, then it will be safe for your kids to be around those adults. And if enough people get vaccinated in the community, then the incidence in the community will go down. The virus will be less common, and kids are less likely to encounter it. So all of those things combined can help keep kids safe even before they are eligible for vaccination.
Let's take another call with Dr. Angie Rasmussen. Jean is on Lopez Island. And Jean, what would you like to know?
Hey, Bill. Thanks for taking my call. That last one was good because I'm just picking up my five-year-old granddaughter from preschool, and we were wondering about that. I'm wondering if there are statistics on the percentage of unvaccinated people that are testing positive, being admitted to the hospital, and dying, breakthrough versus vaccination versus unvaccinated. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a great question, Gene. And unfortunately, the numbers for that are very unreliable for a couple reasons. One, we don't really know the total number of breakthrough infections because many of them are likely asymptomatic. So it's really very difficult to figure out the denominator in that equation if you want to look at breakthrough infections that result in severe disease, hospitalization, or death over the total number of breakthrough infections. But generally, it's thought to be extremely low. Of the breakthrough infections themselves with the mRNA vaccines anyways, we do have fairly reliable data about that, and they are very, very low. And in some cases, you know, people will test positive. Technically, it's a breakthrough infection, but they'll have absolutely no symptoms. The positivity will be transient, which suggests that, you know, they have a very short-lived infection, almost an abortive infection that's rapidly cleared. You can probably debate all day whether or not that actually is an infection, whether that is COVID. So we really just don't know, but my guess would be that it's quite rare. I wish I could put more numbers to it, but unfortunately, we just aren't counting breakthrough infections well enough. We're not catching enough of them to really be precise about those numbers.
Thank you for the question, Jean. Dr. Rasmussen, we're down to our last minute or so. You're in Canada. Do you think the Canada border is going to open? I don't know. When do you think it's going to open?
Well, I hope it opens soon because my husband is still in the U.S. And he's dealing with moving all of our stuff from Seattle here to Saskatoon. And he can get in because he does have a work permit, so he has permission to travel. But the Canadian government and the U.S. government is actually meeting today to discuss a phased border reopening plan. And that is alongside Canada's supplies of vaccines increasing and Canada getting more and more people with at least one dose of the vaccine and some people fully vaccinated. So I think as more and more people become fully vaccinated in Canada, as case numbers continue to go down, we'll see those border restrictions be more and more relaxed over time. And hopefully we can start traveling back and forth the way that we used to. I'm hoping that that's by August because one of my best friends is getting married in Seattle and I'd really like to be able to go to his wedding without too much trouble.
I wish that for you and all of us, Dr. Rasmussen. I know you've got to go. Thank you for your time today.
Oh, it's really a pleasure, Bill. Anytime.
Okay, good. We'll take you up on that. Let's talk again soon. Dr. Angela Rasmussen with the Vaccine and Infectious Disease Research Organization. She's a virologist at the University of Saskatchewan in Canada. Thank you for all your good questions. We'll do it again soon. This is The Record on KUOW. One of the most powerful tools a government executive has, which also makes it controversial. We're giving one politician the power to just scrap pieces of legislation. The Washington Supreme Court's considering a case called Washington State Legislature versus Jay Inslee, and at the center of the case is the question of how far the veto power can go. And here to explain is Seattle Times legislature and state government reporter Joseph O'Sullivan. Joseph, thanks for coming on today. I don't hear you, Joseph. Do you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Gotcha. Joseph O'Sullivan of the Seattle Times. What is at issue in this trial, this case before the Washington Supreme Court?
Well, I guess, first of all, for anybody who was paying attention last month, the governor issued two vetoes for his clean energy legislation that he signed up in Shoreline.
Yep.
And the vetoes dealt with making those programs contingent on the passage of a statewide transportation package. That was a big debate this year at the legislature. And the governor made two vetoes in those bills to basically de-link any transportation package with the implementation of those. And one of those was controversial because it was considered less than a section of a bill. And so sort of funny timing because the governor did this back in 2019. And the Washington legislature alleges that he is overstepping his veto authority. And so this case came before the state Supreme Court sort of around the same time as this more recent veto. What's at issue is the Constitution gives the governor power to veto entire bills that come to his desk or sections of bills or appropriation items, like spending items within those. The governor, in both the veto in 2019 of his statewide transportation package and also this year, he vetoed single lines in a bill. And the legislature says that's going too far. He doesn't have the constitutional authority. And they worry that if the governor can just veto any line in a bill, he can just go through whatever legislation he wants and just sort of perfect it to his desire by slashing his red veto pen.
Okay, so he can veto a section of a bill, but maybe not a single line. Is that crystal clear in the state constitution? I'm guessing it's not.
It's not crystal clear in the Constitution, and there's been a few cases come before the Supreme Court before that touched on this, although not very recently, not in the last 15 years or so, I don't think. And so the state Supreme Court now is tasked with figuring out whether, whether the governor's actions were appropriate, whether, you know, a single line is considered a spending item that he could veto. And they're in a position where they have to, whatever they do could tip the balance of power a little bit between the governor and the executive branch and the legislature and the legislative branch.
Yeah, balance of power. And to be clear, you're not talking necessarily about Republican versus Democrat, which is one of the things I find interesting about all of this. This is not just a matter of Republican legislators complaining about a Democratic governor vetoing single statements in their bills. This is sort of a bipartisan frustration.
It's a bipartisan frustration, and you saw that again last month when the governor issued his vetoes of the clean energy legislation. Democratic House Speaker Lori Jenkins had a statement. She said, you know, the governor's partial veto reaches beyond his constitutional powers, and we will ask the Washington courts to again rule on the balance of legislative and executive branch powers. So they are concerned about the actions the governor's taken.
One of the things that the governor's accused of doing is destroying a so-called grand bargain that legislators crafted to get the legislation to his desk. Is that a legal argument or just more of a balance of power? You should respect the legislature more than you do. Does the fact that the legislators agreed to something and then Governor Inslee vetoed parts of it, is that coming into play in this court case?
Not in the court case, and that's really more of a political argument than a legal argument.
Yeah.
You know, the governor said that he wasn't interested in tying the transportation package to these pieces of climate legislation that he has wanted for years. And in fact, the two vetoes that he made in May, one is to his carbon cap and trade bill, the other is to the clean fuels bill. The way the language was structured in the carbon cap and trade bill, it was actually a section. So he vetoed a section, and I don't think anybody's contesting the constitutionality of that one. They don't like the politics of it. But the clean fuels bill, the language was structured a little differently. And so once again, he went inside a section to veto that language out. Now, we may see that in a second legal challenge after the Supreme Court handles this one. It remains to be seen whether the first court decision, what bearing that might have on this more recent veto.
Well, what if somebody didn't like the state Supreme Court's ruling on this and proposed to amend the state's constitution to make it more clear? Where do you think the public will and the political will would fall there? And what would we do with our state constitution if we decided we want to make it clear?
They could certainly do that. And in fact, if you go all the way back to, I believe, 1974, Washington voters approved a constitutional amendment that put some of these limits to the governor's veto power in place, including the part where he could only veto, I believe the section was in there that year. So Washington voters have weighed in on this before. I don't know that you'll see anything. I mean, it takes a lot of effort to get a constitutional amendment going and before the ballot. And it should also be noted that while Democratic legislative leaders have criticized the governor on this, they didn't come back in a special session and attempt to override his vetoes, which they could have done if they had the votes and the willpower.
Yeah, that's true. Well, what about Governor Inslee compared to previous governors? Is Governor Inslee especially aggressive about wielding the veto knife?
He has made some interesting uses of it. These examples that we've mentioned right now. But back in 2016, he made another creative use of the veto. There were no agreements between Democrats and Republicans on some budget items, and so he actually vetoed 27 bills to make the point to lawmakers that they should get back to work on their budget stuff. And I believe the governor later came back and the legislature, once they got an agreement and had the session wrapping up, the legislature came back and overrode those vetoes. It was a symbolic thing then, but it was sort of a preview of the governor trying to sort of test his strength through this avenue.
Okay, finally, Joseph, you've said a little bit about what's at stake here, the balance of power among the executive and the legislative branches. Will you sum this up for us? What for someone maybe just joining us, the Governor Inslee's veto power is being contested. And what would you say are the most important ramifications of how this turns out?
Well, if the court rules in the governor's favor, it could greatly expand any future governor's ability to go in and make specific, very specific changes to legislation. So it's the legislature that is tasked with passing bills and writing them and getting them to the governor's desk. And the veto traditionally is sort of a counterweight to that. So the governor has some say in what gets to his desk. And so this could dramatically expand what the governor might be allowed to do from his end of things. And, of course, the court could rule against the governor, too, and potentially even restrict some of those powers and act his powers a little weaker than they are now, and that might give the legislature a little more power.
And as you said, if the legislature is that unified in opposition, override the veto.
Yes, they can always do that.
There's that. Joseph O'Sullivan covers the Washington State Legislature and state government for the Seattle Times, and we've been talking about this court case, which got sort of juiced up again with this most recent legislative session veto from Governor Inslee. Joseph, good to talk with you again. Thanks for this.
Thank you for having us.
Still to come on KOW's The Record, the New York Times has just released an investigation into how Amazon treated its warehouse workers during the pandemic, and you're going to meet one of the authors of that report in just a moment. While so many Americans were losing work in the pandemic, Amazon was thriving, making deliveries fast, tracking its workers' productivity, hiring those workers, and profiting a lot. But who paid the price for all that hiring and all that warehouse efficiency while a virus raged? A New York Times investigation finds that Amazon kept warehouse workers in the dark about COVID conditions in some cases, and the company asked warehouse employees to work at a rate that the Washington State Labor Department has called, quote, causing hazardous exposures in the workplace. Here to explain is one of the authors of that investigation, Seattle-based New York Times tech correspondent Karen Wise. Karen, welcome back to the show.
Sure. Hi, Bill.
Before we get into what happened at the New York City warehouse that you investigated, could you describe what it's like working inside one of these Amazon warehouses?
Yeah, they're enormous buildings. These are kind of the classic, what they call fulfillment centers. And there's kind of a couple of core jobs that essentially unload products, put them into these kind of robot-like bookcases, if you will, that move around, that store the products. And then there's another group of people that pick the products out off these robot bookcases or robot shelves. And then another group of people that kind of package them in a box and ship them out the door. So that's kind of, stowing it away, picking it, and then packing it. And one thing that's really interesting, a lot of people think that idea of the rate is really about going fast, fast, fast. And yes, Amazon does want kind of speed, but a really important part is actually one of the reasons they monitor rates is to have consistency, because if the person at the front of that system is too slow at putting products into the robots, there won't be enough products for people down the line to pick off of them. So it's really about meaning what they call flow through this whole building. And then actually Amazon's become so big, it has these very complex network of warehouses where one building affects multiple buildings in a region, and the delivery vans that we see going around, and it's this kind of algorithmically driven network that all operates as one big organism.
And workers are tracked on that rate, as you say, for flow. They're tracked on how much time they take off work. Based on your investigation, how did Amazon treat its New York City warehouse workers during a very special time, the pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, we found that in general, Amazon built a very robust response to the pandemic. You know, there were not the kind of known outbreaks like you had at a meatpacking facility. I mean, they really kind of operationalized a virus response. But it was part of this period where there was a pattern of incredible churn among its workforce. And so it hired tremendously and grew tremendously. And it hires in this process that is basically almost entirely virtual. So Amazon doesn't do interviews. If you go to work in the warehouse, you fill out an online assessment. And that's a process that has let it scale and hire at the speed that it does. It's internally called something called lights out hiring. And Amazon had developed it all, you know, both to scale and then to remove what Jeff Bezos saw as potential bias in a hiring process. But as a result, you end up with people who have never talked to somebody basically before they start working there. And it's not an easy job. And you have a huge amount of attrition. So people leave, especially in the first month or two, there's very high turnover. And I think one of the kind of foundational things we learned in this reporting is that Amazon's turnover rate is roughly 150% a year, which is much higher than the warehousing and logistics industry. And it's actually so high that when Amazon opens new buildings in counties, it drags up the turnover for the entire warehousing industry in the county, because it's both a large employer and it has this really unusually high churn. So it's this kind of high churn environment where you have lots of new people kind of really attracted to the work because Amazon offers, good minimum wage jobs. You know, the minimum wage is $15 and higher. In New York, where we focused, it's now over $18 as the starting wage. And it also offers good benefits. A lot of people really appreciate the healthcare in particular that Amazon offers.
Well, especially during the pandemic, Amazon faced this problem, and I'm curious how much you think it has to do with size, remoteness, speed, exploitation. But there was the issue of a lot of people in lots of jobs just stayed home for their safety, and Amazon was allowing unpaid time off. But at some point, Amazon decided people wanted deliveries, and deliveries were slowing down. That's the opposite of what Amazon wants. And they started calling workers in relatively suddenly. What happened there?
Amazon very early allowed workers to take unlimited unpaid time off in the warehouses, and attendance plummeted virtually overnight, down almost a third. And so they're all of a sudden at a time of this incredible consumer demand, everyone going, I need my hand sanitizer and I need my gloves and all these things. There was a crazy high demand at a time that they had less labor available than normal. And so they did some temporary hires. And that kind of brought them closer to normal. But at some point they said, look, we need to figure out how many workers we have and we need to grow to meet this demand. And so they ended this unlimited unpaid time off and basically said to people, okay, May 1, you got to come back. And if you don't want to come back, you got to apply for a leave. And so it kind of, this abrupt decision, there was kind of an internal debate about, do we bring people back quickly or slowly and give them more flexibility? And there was a team arguing that, well, if you bring them back more slowly, fewer people will basically quit or lose their job for not returning. But in the end, the Amazon executive in charge of operations decided to do what someone deemed the cold turkey response of just doing a clear cutoff and then give people these leave, ability to take a leave. And they made it leave more flexible to apply for. But the leave team, this HR team, got totally overwhelmed by all these requests. And they were using, it had been a team that we found, we talked to more than 25 people who dealt with the leave team. And and they felt that in the past there had always been troubles with the technology, and the leave system didn't communicate with the employee attendance system. And so that just had this huge backlog because of the pandemic, dealing with some really glitchy technology. And it created a very chaotic sense where people who were on approved leaves were getting notifications that they were abandoning their job and might be fired. We have some instances of people actually being fired while they were on an approved leave. So, and then also just talk to HR people we heard who were scrambling to try to make sure people weren't fired and to try to save their job. So it was kind of a lot of factors kind of stressing at once, and just it was a period of just kind of chaos. But also it's Amazon's HR systems and their employment model broadly has just been really strained as it's grown so big so quickly. And so that's how you have this high turn and how you have these problems. You know, we have examples of someone being fired who wasn't supposed to be and someone who was supposed to be fired who wasn't. So it's just the kind of precision we're used to the company had not been built into the HR and kind of employee management system.
Well, that's, I'm hoping to get your reporter's take after this this New York Times investigation that you were part of how much we should put this down to pandemic overwhelm, you know, once in a lifetime, et cetera, chaos, how much to remoteness that you described, the remote hiring, how much to the hugeness of the company, how much to callousness or even exploitation of their human labor force?
Yeah, you know, the mix of things. You know, the pandemic was a stress test, right? And in some sense, it showed the strength of Amazon's system because it ultimately did really come back and bounce back and really deliver for people when they were homebound. It did hire a tremendous number of people last year, despite the pandemic. And it could do that because it had all this virtual technology and all these systems in place. But at the same time, the kind of lack of kind of human cohesion created all these other problems that were kind of ready to happen. So you have a place where there's just not much human connection. You know, one local manager might have 100 different employees that they're overseeing or 90 different employees that they're overseeing. And when you have employees coming and going so quickly, there's just not these tight connections that where if someone does have a problem, they can find the right person easily to fix it. So you kind of had systems that were kind of primed to both produced in some ways and really struggle in other ways.
This is New York Times.
And the question about the intent is very interesting. You know, one of the things we learned is that, you know, Jeff Bezos has this idea that a stagnant workforce isn't good, and that it can lead, entrenchment won't lead to the kind of going above and beyond that he wanted Amazon to be, that it was a road to mediocrity. And so he actually wanted people to cycle out of the workforce. So Amazon says, you know, that they want people to have careers and they're happy to support them. But at the same time, they also say, you know, we're happy to be there for a short period in people's life that helps them that way. But Jeff had this model of kind of encouraging churn in some sense and incentivizing people to leave.
Yes, your story writes that company data showed most employees according to Bezos, that data showed employees becoming less eager over time, that Bezos believed people were inherently lazy. Quote, what he would say is that our nature as humans is to expend as little energy as possible to get what we want or need. I did have to wonder, isn't that kind of the premise of Amazon's business, that we would rather get something delivered than go to the store? Is Bezos seeming to base that on data, or on, is that a kind of a human, does that say something about the Amazon values, and do those values show any signs of changing?
Yeah, so this is exactly, you nailed it. You know, he saw this as a kind of a general truth that humans do the kind of least amount of work necessary. And that's why Amazon has a business. You know, it is easier to click than to drive to a store.
Right.
And their whole, and that the convenience and doing things with less energy is why Amazon is so successful. But he also saw that true not of people as consumers and also as workers and not just hourly workers. You know, I talked to people who explained it in Seattle, if you didn't do the analysis, if you didn't really push, he would go back and say, no, do it again. He would create these mechanisms to really push and force people to really go the extra mile in their work. And that's true kind of up and down Amazon, essentially. And it's part of why it's been, you know, you could say successful, but it also has this result, this kind of mindset of you know, in like the case of these hourly workers where it's acceptable for to have this kind of high churn.
Well, after the union vote, which, by the way, was you could interpret as an endorsement of Amazon, that this Alabama warehouse workers, they decided, and it wasn't a close vote, not to unionize. But what do you think this, what Bezos said, and then what do you think actually Amazon is doing, if anything, to treat its workers better?
Yeah, so it's very interesting. Jeff Bezos is, you know, in the swan song of his time as chief executive. He's stepping mm-hmm. down in July.
Yep.
And he said, you know, Amazon has always wanted to be Earth's most customer-centric company. And he's saying, I'm adding a new mission for us to be Earth's best employer and Earth's safest workplace, I believe is the phrasing. And it's not, you know, with the safest workplace, Amazon's actually been rolling out a pretty steady stream of commitments on that front. It's been a little bit less so, I would say, on what he means and what he'll do to be the world's, you know, Earth's best employer. We've seen some pay raises already, and Amazon's also wrote out some new diversity commitments, including saying that they will try to have attrition be equal across different races. So you're seeing some hints of it, but it's not clear, you know, if there's going to be the kind of moonshot for attrition or the moonshot for being the best employer in the same way that you had the moonshots to create Alexa or to create a drone or things like that. You know, that's kind of this open question of how does this promise or this gauntlet that he's put out there, how does that manifest itself?
Karen Wise is the Seattle-based New York Times technology correspondent and is one of the authors of this new New York Times investigation about how Amazon has treated its workers, particularly during the pandemic at the big warehouse in New York City. Karen, Bezos is in the news now for how little he and other billionaires pay in taxes. ProPublica reported that Bezos paid zero federal income tax in 2007, while his personal fortune grew by $3 billion. Do you think news like that is going to lead Congress to tax the wealth of Bezos and others and not just income?
Yes. I mean, it's certainly fueling, you know, different aspects of the debate about it, you know, and it's obviously we have, you know, a different, you know, Democratic Congress and you have a Democratic White House, but exactly what form it is, I have not been following it closely enough to know what mm-hmm. you can take, but this is, it's sort of helping elevate this question of, are we taxing people equitably? And what is someone's fair share? You know, the argument for not taxing wealth is that people use the money to invest in different ways and they have, you know, they have risk associated with it and stuff like that. So, but I think the ProPublica story shows the impact of the policy choice to not tax wealth and ask, like, is this the fair thing to do, you know, are people like Jeff Bezos or like the, you know, other richest people in the country, is there a way that they should be forced or required to pay more? And if so, how? Like, how do you build those mechanisms?
Also, speaking of billionaires, Bezos' ex-wife, Mackenzie Scott, just announced she has donated $2.7 billion among hundreds of organizations, including Wing Luke Museum in Seattle. So yet another big donation drop for her. What stood out to you about her donation and the statement she released about it?
Yeah, her donation, she came out, you know, with her, I believe it was about a year ago, she came out with her first donations, and it was, you know, a lot of money very quickly, very focused on equity. And she, the line she had, oh God, let's see if I can remember it, for this new batch, which was a huge amount of money in one quarter, was essentially that she wants to right the systems that have created her wealth in the first place. And so she talked about the kind of wealth inequality, racial inequality, and you know, I'm curious, like, how much she thinks her personal wealth and what and Amazon's role in that, because that is where, I mean, her personal money is essentially Amazon stock, and so it's fascinating to see her giving evolve and become, you know, as she explains it publicly. I don't know. I mean, what I won't give to have dinner with her, right?
Can I come?
Please.
Thanks.
No,
thanks.
Second dinner.
Okay. Okay. That's good. Finally, are you going to opt out of Amazon Sidewalk today? And maybe you should briefly explain that. We got like a minute left. I'm just curious.
Yeah. Amazon Sidewalk is this program Amazon has to kind of help extend Wi-Fi, to create a mesh network on products like your Ring doorbell and stuff like that. And it's basically a little controversial because Amazon defaults to having you do it, which means you might be sharing bandwidth with strangers on the street. And there's actually this interesting question if whether it's even allowed to happen under the contracts customers have with internet service companies. Hmm. But it's this big, you got to go through many steps to opt out. And so it's creating quite the brouhaha among kind of like privacy and kind of tech policy people questioning, like, can it even do this? And why would you enable this in a kind of opt-out mode? As we know, defaults are powerful.
I know. We got to go, Karen. Are you opting out or not? Or do you want to stay?
I don't have any devices. I don't have
any devices. Oh, really? Oh, let's talk about that sometime. The tech correspondent for the New York Times based in Seattle, Karen Wise, a non-gadgeter, at least in some ways. Karen, thank you so much.
Great. Thanks, Bill.
The New York Times investigation into a New York Amazon warehouse is called The Amazon That Customers Don't See. That's our time on the record today. Join me again, same time here on KUOW.